Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Cut the housing allowance for military couples. It may sound outlandish, but that's what a recent audit by the Army recommends the Defense Department do. Cut some basic housing allowance benefits for dual military couples. In response, DOD gave that recommendation a pass. Federal News Radio Scott Massioni joins me with more. Scott, what exactly are the dual military couples in the scenario? How does this whole thing work?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a confusing term. So dual military couples are two military spouses that they're both active duty military. And in this case, they live together under the same household, and they most likely have a dependent, which is important for this article.
A child, typically.
Right. Yeah, most likely. So, you know, it's two people in one house getting basic housing allowance for this one house. So, you know, the Defense Department decided to take a look at that and say, you know, are we paying a little too much for two people in one house?
So, in other words, if you're a single military person, you get, let's just make it easy, $100. But if you are part of a dual military couple, then you get $200.
Right.
And the presumption of the audit is you're going to still live in the same place with one or two people.
Right. And then when you have that dependent, you might get $220 because they're paying you a little bit extra because you need a bigger house to have that kid. You need that extra bedroom.
Two-bedroom shack. Right. Okay. Then what's the problem?
So the problem is that DOD, they're always looking to cut corners and save some money. And they're saying, you know, if we just, this isn't DOD actually saying, this is a military, an Army audit. They're saying if we can just cut that dependent, you know, that 220 down to 200, then we could save probably about $300 million. And what kind of brought this on is there's a disparity between the amount of money that these military couples actually receive, which is about almost $500 million a year, and what the actual local housing costs are, which is about $250 million a year. So that you can see there's about a quarter of a billion dollar disparity there between what they're receiving and what the local housing market says.
So that means if your rent is lower than your allowance, you get to keep the difference. You get the allowance anyway.
That's right. Yeah, you get it anyway. It's a flat fee.
Did the idea of giving actual rent or the allowance, whichever is lower, come up?
So that's something that's actually in the NDAA right now for the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Oh, they think like me.
Yeah. So my good friend over at Military Times, Leo Shane, wrote about this on Monday. And so what they want to do is instead of giving a flat fee based on rank, they look at the zip code and look at all the housing markets, and they just take the utility and the rent, put it together, and then they give it to that military couple. But a lot of critics say, you know, if it's not broke, why fix it?
The recommended savings, $250 million, is that over 5 years or is that every year?
So what the actual, they call it over the project kind of lifetime. The basic rundown is that it's going to be about $52 million annually that they would save. So by taking out that dependent piece of things, so 200 20 in our hypothetical situation down to 200, that would save about $52 million annually.
But DOD says, no, we don't want this.
That's right. So they're really sticking up for these military couples. And, you know, they put out this kind of report to talk about why it's important. It said, while there's savings, you know, they don't want to split hairs on what, you know, different marriages are and how to classify different marriages. And also they said that this BAH is really important to the budget overall. You know, they may not use it for the housing, but it's important for food, utilities, electricity, taxes, all these different other things.
So it's kind of a subsidy with a wink attached, basically.
Right. Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, it may be a little bit more for these guys because they have that child. They have that spouse that's in the household with them.
We're speaking with Federal News Radio Scott Massioni, and you spoke to some experts about this whole topic, and what did they tell you?
Right. So I spoke with Gary Hall. He was the president and CEO of the Association for the United States Navy. And he said, you know, there hasn't been a pay raise for the military in the past few years, or at least one that's tied with the ECI, which looks at the private amount of raises that they get, the private sector. So I actually have a clip of him here, so you can listen to what he had to say.
You look at where the Navy is, it's always by the water, and those happen to be resort areas. So you know, fleet concentrations up in Bremerton, Washington, San Diego, Norfolk, Virginia, Jacksonville. These are high dollar areas, and without basic allowance for housing, they couldn't afford to live in those areas and scrape by. In fact, in San Diego, if you're an E4, so that would be a petty officer third class, somebody that's a journeyman that knows their rate well and is a leader, is maybe 24 years old. Maybe they married their high school sweetheart, and so they're living in San Diego. They're on E4 pay and also using food stamps. So it's horrific.
So that was Gary Hall, president and CEO of the Association for the United States Navy. And, you know, as you can see, it seems like pretty rough situation for a lot of people, even when they have this BAH.
Sounds like a third rail for the military to go anywhere near this if you got the associations and DOD brass afraid of it.
Right. Yeah. You know, this is something that it's hard to take a benefit away from an active duty military officer because, you know, they give up a lot for the nation. And, you know, I did a little digging into what he said. A basic E4 with 4 years of military experience, they get about $2,600 a month. The average rent in San Diego County in March of 2016, that was $1,600 a month. So, you know, that's only about $1,000 left over after rent alone.
Right. And so is the implication of housing allowance that it be more than simply your rent?
Well, you know, the military gives a lot of benefit packages. So, you know, they say this is for rents, for utilities, but it's also kind of just for living. You know, you don't get a lot of money just being in the military. So I think it's kind of a way of retaining people. It's a way of recruiting people and you know, giving them a little something extra.
So housing then really means living in the sense, living subsidy and not so much a rent subsidy.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, it, like I said, it comes with a package of benefits. There's retirement and all these other things that are important to these active duty military officers.
And it's probably a long time since you could do a load of laundry for 25 cents.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We earlier spoke about the NDAA for 2017, and you mentioned that there's some changes in the allowance for that bill. Any other changes we need to know about?
Well, you know, there's the military pay. That's something that they're trying to increase. Right now, it's at 1.6%. That's what the president asked for. And the House has already built in an extra $18 billion so they can get the pay up to 2.1%. That's tied with the ECI. Senator John McCain this week, he has an amendment to try and bump up the amount of money that the Defense Department's going to get, and that'll also get it up to 2.1% if it passes.
All right, lots in play. Federal News Radio, Scott Massioni, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And you can read his story and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. Listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Hacking for Defense class at Stanford University works with sponsors from the government and industry so that students are able to work on real-world cyber problems. I spoke with instructor Steve Blank. He explains not only how the students benefit from this practice, but also how the agencies and companies who send them those problems do too.
There's a couple benefits. One is obviously they could get some very smart another pair of eyes on the problem. These aren't obviously a substitute for world-class contractors for external help or internal resources that we have. But again, another pair of eyes. But there were a couple of larger goals for the class. One is for inside the DOD to help develop a common language for innovation that has been tested and kind of exists out here that helps them work at speed. Two is exposes them to the results of working at speed and allows them to compare it to how they're working and building things. Two is, you know, educates a large percentage of our research university into problem sets that the Department of Defense and Intel community have. As I said, I think bridging this disconnect between the civilian world and our military is one of our goals here.
And how does it work in actuality? Does the DoD drop off a problem and check back 12 weeks later, or is there daily interaction?
That's a great question. Actually, we've set up a clearinghouse to basically beat the bushes in the DoD, or at least we did for the first set of problems. Now we have problems.
Now they're beating your door
down. And we act as a clearinghouse for those problems. And the clearinghouse means, number one is does the sponsor understand what their role is? And just as you asked, the sponsor doesn't just drop off the problem, because one of the things the students have to do is they have to talk to 10 to 15 stakeholders a week. That is users, warfighters, concept developers, program managers, etc. And the sponsor is kind of the gatekeeper. You can imagine that might be difficult but not impossible at JIDA. Well, let me just point out that one of the problem sets are from the NSA, and they don't have a long history of talking to too many people, but yet they have been incredibly responsive. In fact, the agency is actually on the cutting edge of being innovative at speed. You'd be really proud of, and your listeners would be really proud of what they're doing, but the other agencies in the DoD as well, JIDA, SOCOM, and I go down the list, of actually bringing us problems, us working with them on how to scrub those problems to an unclassified level, teaching their sponsors what their role is going to be during the 10 weeks of the class. We were, as I said earlier, kind of, that was one of the hypotheses we had, but we're unsure would be true, is whether, A, we could get enough problem sets, and B, whether the sponsors can ever actually provide unclassified access at scale. Because one of the things the students do is, as I said earlier, the goal isn't to build another set of demos for the DoD. There's more technology demos than, there's probably one every 12 and a half seconds.
Sure.
The real question was, could the students deeply understand the problems that the sponsor had never been exposed to the DoD, build an iterative set of solutions, and actually understand by the end of the class how to get this solution acquired and deployed, and not just demo it. Anyway, I could demo something. It's, what's the acquisition process within our lifetime? How do you deploy something at scale? What does that look like? How would you get the money for this? Who cares about this? And there was a lot of skepticism of whether you could take students from zero to, being knowledgeable and making a dent in a reasonable period of time.
We're speaking with Steve Blank, consulting associate professor at Stanford University. And what about the DIUX effort that is going on, the satellite station that the Pentagon has landed in Silicon Valley? How does this relate to that, or does it?
That's a great question, because when we originally built the class, we obviously were aware of them. DIUX is essentially the DoD's innovation outpost in Silicon Valley, and now, as was just announced, in Boston area, and I'm sure there will be more outposts in other areas of innovation throughout the country. As the class proceeded, they ended up adopting us and providing an enormous amount of support in terms of access, expertise, liaisons, etc. And I think they learned a lot from being part of our class, but boy, we and our students certainly learned a lot by having them support an amazing help.
Do you think the cultural bridge, or is there a cultural divide between DoD and the Silicon Valley gestalt?
Oh, of course. There's a cultural bridge on multiple levels. One is just, as I said, when we ended the draft 40 years ago, at least if you were going to research university, the odds of you wanting to join the military or intel community after you got your degree was, not zero, but pretty close to zero. And so that wasn't just a Silicon Valley problem. It was a general problem I wanted to solve. And so there was almost no knowledge of how the DoD and combatant commands operated and what they were doing for the country and the issues they faced. I think post-Snowden, there's a whole other set of cultural issues that are about security of data and safety. And again, I just think we do it on the intel side. We do the world's worst possible job of communicating what the agency's goal is in communicating its role in keeping Americans safe. I thought there was an enormous gulf. But it turns out, as I said, there's just this huge latent demand for understanding and helping. So I think even on a deeper level, in spite of all that, I had more students sign up for this class than I've had for anything else I've taught. And I have a pretty popular class at Stanford.
So what's your goal now next? Do you plan to make this some sort of a regular ongoing program? And do you expect the Pentagon to keep bringing it over and the various DOD agencies?
Yeah, this was a science experiment. So this was our prototype. And, we thought if it didn't work, it would slowly fade into oblivion and, no one would know about it. I'm saying this smiling because by class four, we already had universities signed up to kind of teach this in the fall without us ever even announcing that we're going to scale it. We have told people we're going to scale the class now. We already have five other universities signed up, and it looks like we'll get funding from hopefully NDU and maybe other parts of the DOD to make this a permanent program. As I said, I want this to scale the same way my other class for the National Science Foundation scales, and that is at 53 other universities. You can imagine solving, not just 10 problems a year, but 1,000 problems a year, and more importantly, exposing thousands of kind of our best and the brightest to maybe a different career, and or at least understanding the role of the DOD and intel community. And until we have some formal form of national service, this will be one part of contributing to that.
Steve Blank is a retired serial entrepreneur and instructor at Stanford's Hacking for Defense class. Share both parts of this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click share with friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.